Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins. That's coming up real shortly. And while that show is on the air, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 516-620-3602 or go to give to WBAI.org online. Now stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins coming up.
Here's some advice for your friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone. They got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
Good evening. That was Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges on alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York City of 1970. And before them, Humphrey Bogart as the idealistic newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer there's nothing, baby, he can do to stop the presses. I call this show Deadline NYC. I took the name, as you can tell, from Deadline USA. This is episode number 2. So I had our maiden voyage last week. It went fine, thanks to ace engineer Reggie Johnson, who's at the helm again this week. Thank you, Reggie. Last week, we talked a lot about the work of my late friend, the great investigative reporter Wayne Barrett, and a new collection of his stories, Without Compromise. And we spent a lot of time talking about Wayne's work on Donald Trump. Wayne died in 2017, just as Trump was taking office. But in the months before that, he was in a royal lather, and few people could get in a royal lather the way Wayne could, about that Trump was succeeding not just because there wasn't a lot of great investigative stories being written about him, but Wayne believed fervently that TV and cable TV were just failing to follow them up. Instead, they were running his rallies wall-to-wall, his toxic speeches, and the TV execs were making no bones about how they were making a fortune off of Trump in 2016, who was just great for their business. And when he said that, and in the months and years since, it's just echoed a chord with me, because it's clear to me that Trump long benefited from this kind of media division, you know, investigative stories on one side, celebrity gossip press on the other, long before his own TV show made him a national celebrity. The local New York media really helped launch him. And I don't think there's any doubt but that the New York City press did that because Trump was also great for business. And it wasn't just the front pages in the New York Post, like best sex I ever had. It was because anything to do with the guy was good for sales. He was kind of our gold-plated carnival barker. And we, collectively, the media, kind of made him an icon for wealth and success, even though almost everyone in our business, everyone, knew that the man was not only a municipal menace, but also a lousy businessman, something he really didn't even try to hide. We knew all about his efforts to try to prevent integration of his apartment houses. We knew he was evicting elderly and disabled tenants. We knew how he was destroying precious sculptures atop the old Bonwit Teller building when he was building Trump Tower. And this was one of my first stories about Trump for the Daily News, that he didn't even pay the right wages to the demolition workers who did that work. Trump's reputation was so bad that even New York City's deputy mayor for business once said that she wouldn't believe Trump, quote, if his tongue were notarized. And yet, his face and his antics were so valuable to the press that at my paper then, the Daily News, the late, great Pete Hamill, who was editor for a while, after he told the publishers of the paper that he just wasn't going to put Trump in the paper as much because he was just making it up, Pete quickly got sacked and Trump stayed in the paper. So I want to dig into this stuff a little bit today. We've got a murderer's row of journalists coming up. That's a baseball term, folks. It means they're big hitters. They didn't murder anyone. But these folks are going to talk with me about the way that Donald Trump was covered in the New York City media. We're going to talk first with two reporters, Neil Barsky, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, and Charles Bagley, formerly of the New York Times. And then later in the show, we'll be joined by Michael Powell, a New York Times columnist and reporter who has his own Trump history, and he'll try to help us make sense of it all. Neil Barsky's first at bat. He's one of the smartest people I know. After covering business as a reporter, he managed a hedge fund that I think he did pretty well, to say the least. He then left the financial world and went on to produce an award-winning documentary about former Mayor Ed Koch. And then he founded the Marshall Project, this marvelous nonprofit journalism organization focused on criminal justice issues, one that I've been proud to write for. So, Neil, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Listen, let me read you a couple lines from an op-ed that you wrote for the New York Times back in the summer of 2016. The title was Trump, the Bad, Bad Businessman. And you write, quote, hanging on my wall is a letter written on gold leaf stationery, dated March 22nd, 1990. Dear Neil, it reads, from your first incorrect story about Merv Griffin to your present Wall Street Journal article, you are a disgrace to your profession. And there's an exclamation point after disgrace. Sincerely, Donald J. Trump. And I'm sure it was signed with that unmistakable giant up and down thing that he does. Yeah, well, so what did you do exactly that got him so bent out of shape?
Well, you know, for years I hung that on my bathroom wall kind of as a badge of honor, and only in the last, I'd say, 4 years to the day has it become a kind of a bitter relic. Never in my wildest nightmares did I think we'd be faced with the Trump administration. So as funny as the episode may sound, it actually has quite a, in my view, a kind of quasi-tragic end. But be that as it may, yes, I covered Donald Trump very closely for the Wall Street Journal and before that for the Daily News. And this was through the mid-'80s and the late-'80s. And I would say I was arguably the most visible reporter, a business reporter, covering Trump. The gossip columns were full of Trump stuff. But in terms of actually chronicling his business, I think, and he would admit this, he wrote about this himself, that I was sort of in his face the whole time. And our dear friend Wayne Barrett and I became friends, and you know, I was helped him on his book, et cetera. So I knew Trump over a long period, probably, say, 86 to 90, 91. And if there was a single insight I had, not that he was a bigot and not that he was a crook, but that he was a bullshit artist and that he lied about the level of his success. And this seems like a very obvious observation, but at the time he would say things like, you know, I'm going to build the world's tallest building. He'd have no plans. He would say, we've sold out on this project, and he would never, you know, sold a unit. So I think, so specifically to your question, what did I do? At that time, he was buying and selling casinos like they're going out of style in Atlantic City, and I wrote quite skeptically about one of the deals he did, which was to buy the Taj Mahal from Merv Griffin. And that project eventually filed for bankruptcy, so, you know, being skeptical at the time was the correct view. And guess what? He resented it, and particularly being in the Wall Street Journal, where bondholders would read the article and it would affect the pricing of his bonds, and so there was a sort of a feedback loop there. Anyway, I covered his collapse, mostly, from the, his rise in the mid-'80s to his collapse in the early 90s. And I did not cover, because I'd gone for Wall Street, his recovery, which is was quite a startling development from my perspective.
Where did your stories run back then? Remind us, where did they play? In the Journal gave it pretty good play,
Article,
did they?
Not only the Journal, but the Daily News. Okay, so I was the Daily News, I think before you got there, 86, 87, 88.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And even then, when he was trying to build the West Side Rail Yard, you might remember there was this big competition to get NBC Studios to the West Side, and NBC was sort of blackmailing the city that they were going to go to Jersey, or stay, and they eventually stayed put. But Trump was very involved. He and Ed Koch were sort of going at it. So right away, I knew if I had the word Donald Trump in a story, this is true of the Daily News and the Wall Street Journal, it would get good play. At the Daily News, we were in the ghetto. We were in the business section, so the goal always was to get up front, right, to get our stories in the news section. And I sort of intuitively knew that if it was about Trump and he said something outrageous, it would show up there. And the Journal wasn't any different. The Wall Street Journal, even though we were very serious and we were very solid business reporters, there was always a fascination with Trump. And there was always a fascination with him because he was famous. And frankly, most real estate people, there are exceptions, but most business people do not want to be in the newspaper. And Trump was different. So Trump was famous, and so, yes, there was a sort of understanding implicit that his name would get better play and his name maybe would sell better in terms of, you know, newsstand sales or whatnot. So he was a name, and we all succumbed to it a little bit.
Neil, you also write in this op-ed that as you watched Trump's career soar in the 80s, you were struck by two things. One, that his list of actual real estate accomplishments were minuscule compared with other successful New York developers who got a lot less publicity. And two, that he lied a lot. Tell us a little bit about those lies, and do you think they ever – why did they never catch up with him?
Well, we could argue they have caught up with him. But the first point is pretty interesting. So in the mid-'80s, 87, 88, New York City – through even the stock market crash of 1987, was going through something of a economic recovery. If you remember, that we had a fiscal crisis in the mid and late 70s, and gradually we rebuilt ourselves as a world financial capital. The city was booming, and Trump was arguably, even by 86, 87, the best-known developer in town. He'd built two buildings. He'd renovated the Grand Hyatt, which had been the Commodore Hotel, which was a tax boondoggle he got through the Beam administration.
$80 million in tax abatements.
Yes. And but let me be a little counterintuitive here. I would give Trump credit for that. He built when New York City was in the balls of its feet, and he had some sort of vision, even though I'm sure there was some corruption of obligating the abatements. Okay. And then there was Trump Tower. Trump Tower, where, if you recall, he destroyed these landmark friezes that were from the old Bonwit Teller. And that was it by 87, I believe. And yet he was a household name. And that was principally, frankly, the New York Times. Not the New York Times business section, but the New York Times had a magazine article about him when he turned 40. And he was trying to build, if you remember, the convention center. He wanted to name it Trump's convention center after his father. Ha ha. So the amount of publicity he got was always disproportionate to what he had actually achieved, which was very little. I give the press a little blame, and I give him a little credit. I mean, we now know that people like you and me, who I think I can assume you're not a huge fan of Donald Trump, consistently underestimate his skills, which are public relations, marketing, knowing other people's weaknesses. But we also have always, or the world, overestimated his business acumen. He is a disaster. He is undisciplined. And I don't know if we're going to get to talk later about his current, the New York Times has been writing a lot about his tax issues and his current situation. I would not be surprised if he loses the election, knock wood, that he has major financial difficulties in 6 months when his loans start coming due. He is a singularly horrible businessman, and a singularly amazing salesman.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people who do good PR, and there's a lot of people who do good sales. And and yet, as you point out, given his accomplishments, the shtick was so far beyond what the actual real-life Donald Trump achievements were. What about the politics? Did you get a look at that at all when you were reporting on him? He was one of the biggest givers, donors.
But, you know, mostly when I was reporting on him, Ed Koch was mayor. And Ed Koch and he had an incredibly adversarial relationship. So I don't know if you remember, but this was in the wake of the competition to land NBC Studios. And Donald Trump, I think it was 87 in the spring, goes after Koch, worst mayor ever, blah, blah, blah. And Koch had a three-word answer for him. Piggy, piggy, piggy. I mean, they really didn't like each other. And they had some similarities. I don't think Koch was as toxic or bigoted. He was bigoted, but not as bigoted as Trump. But they went at it. Now, interestingly, the mayor that helped Trump the most was David Dinkins. Because in 1991 or two, I believe, Dinkins approved, with the assent of Ruth Messenger, the great liberal West Sider, they approved the rezoning of the West Side rail yards, which were controlled by Trump.
Right.
And that was the seat of his recovery. And so it was not Koch, who was arguably more pro-real estate and kind of, you know, the business. It was Dinkins that really catapulted Trump and gave him his new lease on life after he had had a lot of issues with his banks.
And yet at that time, Trump was basically pressing the entire West Side delegation that if you don't do this, that land will lie fallow and the mistake will be on your head. So let me just do a couple of things here. One is let me remind folks that this is WBAI FM 99.5 Pacifica Radio. My name is Tom Robbins. This is a show called Deadline NYC. I'm here with Neil Barsky, and we never use curse words because we know
my
that
bad.
This
I'm
is
sorry.
Like open radio.
Got carried away.
And you know, you can do this on cable TV, but we're not allowed
FM
to do
was
it.
Different, but my bad. I apologize.
That's fine. And we're going to be joined soon by our mutual friend Charles Bagley, who was for decades the leading real estate reporter in the city. You mentioned a minute ago that about your sort of prediction for what's going to be upcoming in terms of Trump's business, win or lose, come next month. Neil, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, if he wins, who knows? I mean, we don't want to go there, but it's hard to dislodge a president from his assets, and there's a lot of corruption. So let's just assume he loses. If he loses, you know, I only know what I've read in the New York Times reports on his taxes. You know, he has personally guaranteed over $400 million of loans. That means that if you or I buy an apartment and we default on the mortgage, the bank has a right to take our apartment back. But they don't have a right to our car or bank account, right? The collateral on our apartment is our apartment. But let's say we said, oh, no, I will guarantee it so that if I can't make my payment, you can get my car, my other assets. Well, that's what real estate developers do from time to time. It's very risky, but they get a lower rate, and sometimes banks require that. In the 80s, Trump guaranteed personally over $800 million on insane acquisitions like the Eastern Shuttle, the Plaza Hotel. And those guarantees were the cause of his near financial collapse. Today we learned he did it again. He guaranteed the loan on the Doral, the country club in Florida, on the Washington Hotel that he controls in D.C. So if the value of those, if he is not able to refinance, if his revenue does not meet the mortgage payments, the banks have a right not just to seize those assets, but to seize his other assets. And here's the irony. The reason he could have those troubles, the reason he could conceivably default on those loans is because of COVID. and the recession, and people aren't traveling, and they're not going to golf courses, and they're not checking into Washington hotels like they did, and whose fault, in part, is the severity of the COVID crisis? His.
Interesting.
So he will.
Let's bring Charlie Bagley into our conversation. Charlie, you there with Hertz?
Yeah. How are you?
Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Thanks so much for being there, Charlie. So listen, I know you've got a million Trump stories, but I was thinking that maybe, you know, we could get you to focus on just one of them. Neil and I were talking earlier about, you know, Trump's tendency to misrepresent, fabricate, and you learned at one point when you were reporting for the Times that one of Trump's business partners in the Trump Soho and other projects was a guy named Felix Sater, who had his own criminal history behind him, as well as wise guy connections. He once attacked a man in a bar. And yet, when you asked Trump about him, well, you tell us. You asked Trump about him, and what did Donald Trump say when you asked him about Felix Sater?
So I had already done all my reporting on Felix, and this guy had a pretty dark history. So I called up Donald Trump, and I said, Donald, I'm doing a story about Felix Sater, a.k.a. Felix Satter. He changed his name by one letter, so you couldn't look him, Google him, and figure out he had a criminal past. And Donald said, well, I hardly knew him. I knew his boss. And I said, oh, really? Well, didn't you go out to Colorado with him? Colorado? I don't think I've even been to Colorado. And I said, sure, you remember. You did one of your inspirational speeches in Loveland, Colorado. Okay. I said, well, Felix was there. He said, there were thousands of people there. I can't account for everyone. I said, but Donald, you got into the limousine with him, and you went off to meet with this Denver developer. And, you know, it was like every single thing. That was what was always so exhausting about dealing with Trump, is you were never getting a straight story. And
when did you first figure this out? I mean, you covered Trump, Charlie. I mean, I don't know if you were there as early as Neil was doing it in the 1980s, but you covered him throughout the 1990s. When did you first realize that this guy is just not going to tell me the truth, if you remember?
Well, I don't know if it was a single event. It was just that, I usually, if I called him, I wanted to know the answers to all my questions ahead of time. And I covered him beginning in the late 80s. Never hard to get a hold of him. I just called his office.
Sure.
You didn't have to.
And you were put right through, correct? Norma Federer would say, hold the line.
Yes, exactly. And then he would get on. And, you know, the first time that happened, I was sort of bowled over. I didn't expect it.
Neil, this is, you were talking about this before, just comparing him to other guys. I mean, you know, we'd have to talk to Howard Rubenstein. We could never talk to Lou Rudin or any
before
of the other big shots.
At the Journal, I worked at the Daily News. Before I worked at the Daily News, I worked for City Business, an obscure business paper. And like Charlie said, you call Donald Trump, you have the word reporter in front of your name, your call goes through.
And was that a smart move, Charlie? Did that score with you?
Well, it
didn't hurt.
No, I mean, I was always wary of the guy. So, it was... I guess it was a familiarity. So, you know, you don't want to antagonize it too much. But it's funny, Neil was mentioning before about how he personally guaranteed these things. And I can recall talking to him in 90 when, he was in desperate straits and the bankers were forcing him to give back his jet, and give back his princess yacht, and give back the football team, and, you know, just all the baubles that he had acquired in the recent years. And he told me he would never personally guarantee loans again. For a long time, I've wondered, you know, how much money does he really have? Because here he had gone on this buying spree of all these golf courses, albeit they were often in distress when he bought them, but golf is a dying sport. Its heyday is past. And I remember talking to another owner of luxury golf courses, where it costs like $200,000 to join. And I said, well, listen, before we talk about anything, I want to understand this business, the golf business. And he laughs and he says to me, look, I don't know anybody that makes money on golf courses. And this guy had six of them. And these are high-end courses. They're not. So his thing has always been a mystery to me. But I also thought that by the mid-90s or so, he was irrelevant to whatever was going on in New York. He wasn't really a developer anymore. He was a merchandiser. And so I didn't want to do stories about him. And by 2004, I thought that he was pretty much finished. And then The Apprentice came along, and it allowed him to reestablish all the Trump mythology, you know, that he was a great businessman and all the rest of it. But I was asked to do a story about The Apprentice for Arts and Leisure at the time. So my story starts out saying, well, you know, look at the camera panning around Trump International Hotel and Tower as the Donald intones, I'm the largest developer in New York. Two things wrong with this picture. A, he never owned Trump International Hotel and Tower, and B, he ain't the biggest developer in New York. And that he then...
Did you get a chance to ask Donald Trump about that inconsistency?
Oh, yeah. I sat at his desk in Trump Tower, and I said, Donald, you're a successful guy. What do you have to go over the top for all the time? He says, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I just watched the first show, the first edition of The Apprentice, and you say you're the biggest developer, and you're not. And he says, what are you talking about? And so I pull out my yellow pad, and I had four columns there. Three other developers, how many buildings they had put up, how many units in each building, and then Donald. And I said, these three guys alone are bigger. Each of them are bigger than you are. And I'm not even counting Lefrak, because nobody will ever build as many as Sam Lefrak. And he averted his eyes. He looked away. And then the story ran on a Sunday, and on Monday morning, the publisher of the New York Times got a letter saying they were going to sue for malice, and that this, you know, I had it in for him. And they said,
what was the basis that they were threatening to sue? That he was going to prove that he was the biggest?
That I wouldn't
kind of an unprovable
to him or one of his pals, That I went into it with the intent of, defaming him, I guess, and in the letter he alleges that it must be because I was unhappy that I would badger him or his office every year for tickets to the U.S. Open, and they would turn me down. So I when my lawyer talked to me about this, I said, this is a joke. Every August, since the day I started at the New York Times, I would get a call from Donald Trump's office saying, what day do you want to go to the U.S. Open with Donald? I said, I went exactly once. And here's the story that I wrote off of information I gleaned there. Then later they said that I had badgered Donald for tickets to see Pavarotti in Atlantic City. And again, I said, I don't know what they're talking about. Anybody who knows me knows I hate New York, Atlantic City, and that Soprano is so far off of my cultural radar, it's not to be believed. I said, if he had said, I wanted backstage passes to see Springsteen, my friends would have thought, wow, might go in the back for that one. But it was just total fantasy. And fortunately, the Times lawyer said, Charlie, Look, this is the whole show.
It was one of his M.O.s, right? I mean, we know that, you know, his first attempt was to try to compromise you, no matter what it was. Wayne, he famously, when Wayne started interviewing him, Trump learned that he lived in Brownsville, Brooklyn, a very poor neighborhood, and Wayne's. Was surprised when Trump said to him, Wayne, you don't have to live in Brownsville. I have apartments, which was a little bit better even than Pavarotti tickets. Yeah. So, listen, it's 5:30. We're here, 99.5 FM, WBAI. It's Deadline NYC. I'm talking to Neil Barsky and Charles Bagley, journalism greats, about days covering Donald Trump. And after this, we'll be back with Michael Powell, who has his own Trump stories to share.
Fly, fly, fly. Bring your lips a little closer. Baby.
Okay, yes. Betty Harris singing the great Burt Burns tune, The Liar. I was just looking for a great tune with the word liar in it for obvious reasons and an excuse to play a great soul tune that doesn't get enough play. My name is Tom Robbins. The show is Deadline NYC. We're here with Neil Barsky and Charles Bagley, veteran journalists, talking about their days covering Donald Trump. And I think we're joined now by another of our compadres, Michael Powell from the New York Times. Michael, you there?
I'm here.
Look at that. Look at that. All right. So listen, the four of us are on. They tell me that WBAI is kind of free-form radio, and you know, we can just have a discussion for the next few minutes. But let me just, Michael, see if I know that you had at least one up close and in person experience dealing with Trump around the time that he had run full page ads calling for the death penalty. After the five teenagers were charged wrongfully with the Central Park rape case. Trump, by the way, has never backed off that ad, has never recognized that those charges were later dismissed after another man admitted the crime. You remember anything about that encounter, and did you go to see the Donald personally?
Yeah, there was myself and another colleague or two, and I'm not going to start naming them because if I get them wrong, one of them will come after me. but We were summoned into, I mean, look, well, let me back up a second. I mean, he was, one of his geniuses, as both Neil and Charlie have gotten at, one of his geniuses was that he understood sort of the tabloid and newspaper, you know, sort of what got into their bloodstream. And, you know, so it was. Oh, and he was perfect for that. He was kind of this P.T. Barnum. I mean, you know, as to use, I guess, Neil's unmentionable word. I mean, but he was a guy who just had a very casual relationship with the truth. And he understood exactly, you know, they wanted sex. They wanted money. I mean, he's thinking about the tabloids. And at the time that the Central Park jogger case happened, you know, they also wanted, I mean, that was kind of everything, right? I mean, it was kind of Wall Street, sex, terrible crime, terrible crime at a time of terrible crime in New York. and in, you know, this iconic Olmsted Park, Central Park, right? I mean, literally the heart of the city. So he, you know, and he jumped on it with this full-page ad, you know, just talking about, you know, his hatred for these, as we now know, guys who were wrongly convicted. But even if we didn't know that at the time, I mean, he was just all in, and it ends with, you know, we've got to bring back the death penalty. So we want to talk to him, and as, you know, both Charlie and Neil have gotten at, I mean, he's the chief of state in New York. If you tell, you know, you say you want to talk to him, you're there. So we get there, and it's really, I mean, it strikes me as very much of a piece kind of with what we're seeing now with him as president, which is that there's kind of a, I mean, he's a nowhere man. I mean, he just kind of he's going on about, you know, this crime and how he hates these. I mean, kind of essentially just kind of repeating the ad, and it's pretty clear, you know, I mean, he's very good at giving quotes. He knows exactly what he's giving you. He knows exactly what he's saying. And there's kind of no there. I mean, you know, it was like after 15 minutes that his eyes kind of go glassy and you're out of there and he's on to, you know, the next.
I'm just curious. Do you remember whether or not he was familiar with any of the actual facts of the case as they were known?
None. I mean, he knew literally. I mean, truly. I mean, he knew nothing more than, you know, what you'd read in the first three paragraphs of Newsday or the Daily News or the New York Post. I mean, there was no sense in which,
looking back, and any of the three of you could jump in on this. What was he after with those ads? Why was he doing it?
I always thought there was.
I'll back off. Yeah, one of the other guys jump in.
Go ahead.
Well, I always thought that he had a calendar on his desk, and if his name hadn't been mentioned in the press for a while, that he would do something to get it out there. And I think it was purely a marketing move that he wanted to establish himself as a player, a man about town. I remember at one point when Giuliani was mayor, and he was getting ready to give the New York Stock Exchange $1 billion subsidy to build a new headquarters. It was a really stupid move. Just when the industry was moving to wires, they wanted an edifice. But Trump appears in a New York Post article saying that he'll build them a new headquarters on the water in Lower Manhattan. And I remember I was astounded that anybody took that seriously. And I called the reporter and I said, you know, that's never going to happen. First of all, the New York Stock Exchange will never get into bed with Donald Trump. And secondly, no one will ever be able to build a building over the water in Lower Manhattan. That's just nonsense. And they said, yeah, I know that. But it was a good story.
But it was a good story.
But there was a symbiotic relationship there where even when you knew it was
well, you know, it's funny. Charlie, when you and I started together at the New York Observer when it was first launched back in 1987, and you know, that was when Trump, the first time, I mean, it's remarkable to think about it 30 years ago, that he was already talking about running for president. And I wrote an item for one of the columns we had in the debut edition of the paper, laughing at him because Abe Hirschfeld, a name hopefully not recalled by too many people because he's probably the only guy who was a bigger buffoon, who actually did go to jail, was the chairman of Trump's would-be campaign committee. And I wrote that having Abe Hirschfeld as the chairman of your campaign committee was a little bit like having Rodney Dangerfield be the head of your campaign. But he was floating the idea in 87. He floated it again in 2000. Neil, did you ever take him seriously when he was starting these conversations about, I could be president before it actually happened?
Well, that postdated me. I don't think he started talking about that until the middle or late 90s. But I have to say that there's a method to his madness. I mean, the man is sitting now in the most powerful person in the world. And I think we're amiss if we dismiss everything he did was for ego or for, you know, manipulative purposes. I think his faults are extreme, but so are his skills. And his skill is to monetize his name. It's not a conventional way of doing business. But when he said he'd be building a New York Stock Exchange on the water, yes, it was BS, but it also enhanced his image. And then some Russian's going to buy his condominium, or a Azerbaijani developer is going to pay him $5 million to develop a hotel. So I think, and maybe even in Central Park 5 was very interesting because it was before I think he had any political aspirations. I think the man had an ability to tap into the public view, and maybe not our view of the world. And at that time, there was tremendous trauma in New York over that crime.
Right.
And I think he overstepped. He used his sort of intuitive bigotry to make his point. But I also think there was an element of simply marketing himself. And you cannot look back and not marvel a little at how skillful he was and how he tapped into things that we were not even conscious of. So when he was saying he'd run for president, he didn't mean he was going to run for president. He meant he's famous. Buy my soap. Watch my TV show.
Hmm.
Okay.
Hmm.
And so there was a marketing and I think the great irony of our time is that he ran for president to support his brand, to build his brand, thinking he would lose. And he didn't lose. And he was ill-prepared, and the whole world was ill-prepared. But this man is a master marketer. And so, yeah, he's crazy, but he's also the friggin' president. And that's
crazy
a scary thought to anyone who covered him.
Let me ask you folks this before we do a little station ID in a couple of minutes, but do any of you ever recall any kind of discussion amongst you and your editors of something along the lines of, hey, listen, Donald Trump is a serial liar. We've caught him time after time. It's not just like purposely miscounting the floors in his buildings to make them look bigger. This is a guy who is misrepresenting everything that we come to him. He's kind of worth a major takeout to kind of say, you know, however you're going to head it, you know, New York's biggest liar, the kind of thing that you could do in a, maybe only in a tabloid. Anybody ever remember any discussions like that? We didn't have them at the Daily News, I can tell you.
Well, most of what I wrote about was debunking his business claims and up until the collapse and his negotiations with his banks. So I don't think you necessarily had to take a step back and say that would be a good Daily News story, you know, the world's biggest liar or New York's biggest liar. But the claims he made about how successful his casinos were or successful his condominiums were, we wrote about that all the time. And so did others. I mean, Forbes.
Yeah, but I'm talking about something, Neil, that would wrap it all up together to like actually trying to put a cap on it.
I'll leave it to the other guys. But at my time, it was too soon. I mean, we were still chronicling his collapse.
Right. Fair enough. Charlie, did the editors at the New York Times ever think,
no,
you know, long before he's running for president, maybe we better, you know, take a deep, serious look at this guy?
No. And I suppose in hindsight, it's somewhat shocking. But I can remember that Trump had insisted on a meeting with the New York Times. So he came in. I was in two of these sessions. The first one he brought Donnie Jr. Little Donnie had very little to say, and then the second time it was with Ivanka. But I was appalled that the entire leadership of the New York Times was having lunch with him. I just felt like, why? He is so irrelevant. That was at one time. I was watching everyone in the room. I think I might have been the only reporter. It was all editors and masthead, people from the masthead. And it was like performance art. Donald walks in the room, sits down in the center of the table, and just starts talking and pretty much talked for the whole 2 hour session. And I'm watching all the editors and, you know, they're all sort of rolling their eyes as they look at one another, but they invited him a second time.
Well, what came of that meeting, if anything, that you recall?
I think he was threatening to pull his ads or something, and it was just about trying to make him happy or placate him. He didn't get any coverage or anything like that, but I think that, you know, for a long time, people were just didn't want to say that the emperor has no clothes. And I think that Donald would have disappeared from the scene if not for The Apprentice. And I think The Apprentice allowed him to reestablish Trump mythology, you know, that he was a great businessman, that he was a shrewd negotiator. And whenever I wanted to bug him a little bit, I'd say, you know, Donald, you're not really a developer. You're a marketing genius. And he would poo-poo that and say, "Oh no, I'm a builder. That's all I am is a builder." But he hasn't been a builder in a long time. Otherwise, I agree with what Neil said, that the guy had a real ear for the public opinion and what would get him out there.
Now, let me ask the three of you the question. Did any of you ever watch Charlie had to watch it for a news story. Did anybody ever just sit down and say, let me check out this show, The Apprentice? Neil, were you watching it at any point?
I watched a total of 0 seconds of The Apprentice.
And Michael?
And I'm there with Neil.
Well,
no, I never watched any of it. Probably, obviously, in retrospect, I should have paid a little more attention.
Yeah, we all should have.
Right.
Listen, but
well,
yeah. The Apprentice aired in 1994-95. Understand that
2004,
period,
right?
No, 94.
2004,
my bad. But through the 90s, he was building 10, 12 buildings on the West Side Rail Yards that had his name on them. He got the two office buildings. It wasn't like he was dormant. It was a sort of a feedback loop. The BS created the opportunity. And so,
well, wait a minute.
You know, I don't think you could totally ignore the guy from a business perspective.
Yeah, but the West Side, he was going to lose the property. The owners of the West Side property were Hong Kong billionaires. It was not Donald Trump, no matter how many times he said it.
Henry Chang owned it. Donald Trump had a major equity investment. I know the details, but the reality is he got that done.
He had 30% of the upside. That,
hold on.
My
he got it.
All right, wait a minute. Spare us the weeds here, guys. Let's just...
No one no one could have gotten that done in New York but Donald Trump. That's what I'm saying. You just can't dismiss him as like, I mean, he's a vile creature. But he had a skill. He had Ruth Messenger, the most liberal, you know, councilwoman, petitioning the mayor to approve a tax abatement for him. He convinced her incorrectly, and he didn't keep his promises, but he got that massive thing done in the early 90s when New York City's economy was in the you-know-what. So,
all right.
You know, I think he did have a skill. I think he's a cancer on the planet. I think he's undisciplined. I think he's going to go broke again. But I don't think he was merely a PR guy. I think he was a guy who converted his PR to some very sizable business deals.
Charlie, after you did that initial piece about the launch of The Apprentice, in which you caught him confabulating as usual about how big he was and how grand he was and what he owned and what he didn't own, did anybody at your paper ever say, you know, let's take another serious look at this guy until he started becoming a political candidate that you recall? I mean, you did, you know, that major story about Felix Sater at some point when he was getting ready to do the Soho Hotel, and yet that seemed to not really spark the kind of interest, or at least the kind of critical mass that would have been needed in the media in order to really shine a spotlight. What was Donald Trump doing with this guy? Am I wrong?
No, there was never. I guess even up until he was running in 2015, nobody took it seriously. And I confess that I was one of the people in this saying, don't worry, he's not going to run. This is just brand extension. And then when he did run, I said, don't worry, he won't stay in the race because he'll never file a financial report. Yep. And then he did. And you know, I spoke to him after he won the New Hampshire primary. And I said, Donald, that probably surprised you more than anyone that you won. And he said, yes. I mean, you never know how heartfelt that is. But I hear what Neil is saying, that, you know, he does have certain abilities and qualities, and that you can't just dismiss them out of hand. But I do think that a lot of what was said that he said about himself went unchallenged. Even now, when you talk about the two office buildings that he owns, I mean, the Chinese billionaires sold the project, and he sued them because they weren't going to give him cash. You know, he wanted cash, and he sued to stop the sale. He was unsuccessful, and what he ended up with was a stake in in those two buildings, which he doesn't control. He has nothing to do with the management or the
probably the lion's share of his. It's probably the lion's share of his net worth. I mean, have a lot of value, and he owns them. He owns the 25% or 30% interest.
I'm not disputing that. What I'm saying in terms of creating something of value, that it's funny that in the end those are his two most valuable assets, and he had nothing to do with building them or marketing them or operating them.
I totally agree.
Well, listen, we gotta wrap up in a couple of minutes, but you know, let me just throw this out to Michael. Let me just ask you this. The answer is pretty obvious, I think, but did we miss a moment, or maybe a lot of moments, when the local media could have or should have sort of taken Donald Trump seriously? He was a television personality. We didn't watch it. Was there another way that this could have happened? Would it have mattered, do you think, if we had done, like, hey, wait a minute, let's take a quick look? Because after he started running, there was some tremendous work that was done about him. What do you think?
There was, and I guess that's what I keep coming back to. And this isn't, look, this is not an argument at all against, hey, you know, good, tough journalism. But there is a sense with this guy. So, like, if we had gone after him, and some did, back even in, with the Central Park, you know, jogger stuff. I mean, so what? I mean, as Neil, I think, very correctly said, he had his finger on the kind of disease zeitgeist at that time.
Yep.
And that worked. And, you know,
and now.
And many times along the way, and I guess it takes, I mean, a lot of credit goes, obviously, to the two guys that are on now, and Wayne Barrett and Tim O'Brien and people who did go after it. But there was always this sense that he was kind of a P.T. Barnum. So do you want to waste all your time going after him? It didn't feel like he was the biggest developer. I mean, you know, overall, over the course of 20 or 30 years in New York, the as Charlie said, the Apprentice felt like a brand extension. He had made this nod in 2000 about running for president. That also felt like a brand extension. A friend of mine at the Washington Post, Robin Givhan, did a kind of a devastating piece riding on the plane with him and just getting at how, you know, this kind of circus with, you know, Al D'Amato there with some young thing in a skirt and his hand on her knee and, you know, you know, Trump just kind of, you know, rambling up and down this plane, and every time she asks him a question that has anything to do with policy, his eyes glaze over. I mean, it's there. That was the Washington
yep.
Post. That was the All
right. All right.
I'm not. He's this weird, you know, kind of Dracula-like figure, and I'm not sure
okay.
anyone knew at any given time. Anyway, there you go.
All right. Well, listen, this has been fun. I'm Tom Robbins. This is Deadline NYC on WBAI-FM. We've been talking with, that was Michael Powell from the New York Times and former reporters extraordinary
Charlie Bagley from The Times and Neil Barsky, who's done many things, including great stories about Donald Trump for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you all very much for doing this. I was a gas. We'll try to do
thank
it
you,
again.
Take care.
So let me just say, if you want to reach me, although I can't imagine why you would, you can find me on Twitter at Tommy Rob. That's TOMMY underscore ROBB. And let's, Reggie, just take it out with a little Oliver Nelson Stolen Moments. Thanks for being here today, folks.
Questions about how to vote in the upcoming election? If so, please listen to this message. You might want to write some of this down. There are three ways you can vote in New York State: by absentee ballot, by voting early in person between October 24th and November 1st, or by voting in person on Election Day on November 3rd. The following links will tell you everything you need to know about the three options. In New York State, go to voteearlyny.org. That's VOTEEARLYNY.org. If you don't have access to a computer, the information is available by phone through the New York State Board of Elections at 800-367-8633. That's 800-367-8633. And if you live in New Jersey, you can access what you need to know to vote by going to vote.org/state-new-Jersey or call your county board of elections. Please join in voting in this critically important election. Thank you. This message has been brought to you as a public service by WBAI Pacifica Radio.
Hey, WBAI listeners and supporters. Tune in Thursday, October 29th from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. for the fifth report of 2020 from the WBAI Local Station Board. This month, the LSB officers are making a return appearance, and you'll also hear from other various members of the board. As usual, they'll all talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network, and they'll ask you for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI. So, mark that date on your calendar. Thursday, October 29th, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. The fifth report of 2020 from the WBAI Local Station Board. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get very many opportunities to speak out in regards to the wrong that was done to my son and the other boys in the Central Park jogger case, as it was called at that time. Very few people stepped up. Yes, Like It Is was there. WBAI was there. And a few others. Majority of those stations that let people like myself speak and tell them what was going on the other side, those stations are gone. If we lose WBAI, where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you